Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is the Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. Joining me on the roundtable this week, we have Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Karen.
Hey, great to be here.
Jesse Ballmert, State Government and Politics Reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Jesse.
Yeah, happy Monday.
And Jeremy Pelzer, Chief Politics Reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Hi, good morning.
So before we talk about redistricting, I wanted to start with what is happening after the assassination of Charlie Kirk, the founder of Turning Point USA, who led the conservative youth movement and is credited with helping President Trump win re-election. Tyler Robinson, 22, of Utah, has been arrested in connection with Kirk's death, and he has not been formally charged, but he's being held without bail. Flags were lowered here and elsewhere, as ordered by President Trump and Governor DeWine. And last night, mourners gathered at Dublin's Kauffman Park. They numbered in the hundreds, if not more, maybe 1,000 by some estimates. And Karen, your colleague Sarah Donaldson was at the vigil. Among the speakers was Vivek Ramaswamy, a close friend of Kirk's and Ohio's Republican candidate for governor. Here's what he said.
Violence is violence. Words are not violence. Violence is violence. And violence is never an acceptable response to words. Not in the United States of America.
He also said this about free speech.
Charlie's death changed me. And just because you have the right to say something does not always automatically make it right to say either.
Karen, what is your take on how Ohio politicians have been reacting over the past few days in the wake of this murder? What stood out to you?
Well, since this is a very Republican state, there's been a lot of an outpouring of support for Charlie Kirk's family, grief for what happened. This vigil is similar to ones that have been held all over the country and even in individual cities. I think there was the expectation that this was not going to be as big as it was. Sarah says that there were about 600 candles that were ordered and they ran out. So this was a pretty big deal. It had, by the end of the vigil, kind of a campaign rally flavor to it in a way. Because, I mean, Vivek Ramaswamy was live streaming it, which he does with all of, well, nearly all of his speeches that he gives on the campaign trail. He was preceded immediately by U.S. Senator John Husted, who will be running for re-election. So, you know, I think it's only natural that people who are running next year would potentially take this opportunity to be in front of people who support Charlie Kirk's viewpoints to talk about their feelings on this and to really advocate for what they say is protection of free speech, which, of course, when you start talking about protecting free speech, you have to think about not only protecting your free speech, but protecting the speech of people who you vehemently disagree with.
Yeah. And Jesse, what's your take on all of this? It's been interesting with the way the media has been balancing it and what politicians are saying and which politicians are saying what. How have you felt about the reaction over the past few days?
Yeah, I think you're seeing a lot of close Ohio ties to Kirk. Obviously, Vivek Ramaswamy was a close friend. Vice President J.D. Vance, a former Ohio senator, was a very close personal friend. He was there to receive the casket. He wrote a very personal note about how Kirk was a early supporter of his before he really was more than an author and did not have that much political support in what was a pretty crowded Republican primary. Kirk was at a Delaware County Republican event pretty recently and was scheduled to come back to Ohio for another event in the near future here. So you're really seeing the influence of this individual on the politics of the state, as Karen mentioned, was very Republican. You're also seeing backlash against individuals who are saying inappropriate things or, you know, who are being facing repercussions for their comments about this situation.
And Jeremy, Vice President J.D. Vance canceled a trip to the 9/11 memorial last Thursday to go to Utah to meet with Kirk's family. And then Vance escorted Kirk's casket and his family aboard Air Force Two. He's also planning to host Kirk's Daily Show today. So the vice president is definitely a big part of this.
He is. Mm-hmm. It shows not only the influence that Charlie Kirk had on the conservative movement and just people around the country, it shows just the influence he's had over people who are now in strong positions of government. Mm-hmm. This caught a lot of people obviously off guard, and we are now in the past the shock of it, and now we're seeing how people are reacting to it, and some of them are reacting with anger, some are reacting with sadness. We will see in the coming days how his assassination, what that leads to going forward in terms of policies, in terms of how this affects politics. And this is just the beginning of the reaction. We're going to see what long-term repercussions come from this on both sides.
And how would you assess his influence among young people, especially, you know, his political movement here in a red state like Ohio? I don't, anyone can take that. I mean, he's, you know, Ohio is very red now, and he's had an impact on young people here.
Well, and I think that that's something that we found out after the 2024 election, this idea that voters who are in those younger demographics were naturally going to skew Democratic. That wasn't necessarily the case, especially with younger men. And so I think he speaks to a lot of the concerns about social issues that some younger voters have. The question, of course, is for a lot of younger voters is how do they view the economy alongside all of that? But yeah, I mean, he had a big impact in Ohio. You've seen all sorts of comments from state lawmakers on social media mourning his death and praising his widow for the statements that she's made. She put out a video over the weekend that was, I think, really got some reaction that was just very personal, and I think some people thought maybe it was a little too close, because it just, I don't recommend you look it up, but it just is like, it's one of those things you have to see. So but anyway,
I mean, he really did two things. One is to go to college campuses and for younger people really present a differing point of view than many of young people had heard. You know, he would go to college campuses and say, you know, I'll debate you on anything. Mm-hmm. And he particularly was one of the leaders of the fight against perceived liberal bias on college campuses. The other thing that he did, though, is he helped people, older Republicans, office holders, he built a bridge to help them reach out to young people too. So he serves as a bridge both to get young people on board the conservative train and to help other conservatives higher up in government to reach out to young people.
There has been some backlash here. A Cincinnati restaurant owner is no longer associated with his restaurant because of what he posted on Facebook. A city council president in Fairview Park in Cuyahoga County resigned over negative comments that he posted after Kirk's murder. A Monroe Falls councilman in Summit County said he and his family have gone into hiding after something he wrote criticizing Charlie Kirk on Facebook. Jesse, what do you make of all of these? The reaction is like everyone has to, in an era of free speech, but you also have to be careful what you say.
Yeah, I think people are entitled to speech, but they also face consequences for the speech that they put out. And that could be negative public opinion, that could be a lost future election, that could be, you know, as we're seeing in the cases that you mentioned. I do think in an age of social media, when our desire to react is like very strong, sometimes just taking like two extra seconds to think about what you're putting out into the world, because there are consequences to that. I think there is certainly among liberals and Democrats opposition to some of the positions that Charlie Kirk took, and a realization that political violence is happening in more than just this scenario. We had the situation of the Minnesota lawmaker who was killed earlier this year. You have situations where there were threats against Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, prominently the assassination attempt of President Donald Trump. And so I think in the desire for some people to either provide opposition to his positions or context to the case, they're just in some really unfortunate choices of words.
And that was actually something that Ramaswamy said last night and urged people to think before they post, so to speak. And, you know, the First Amendment and free speech has never guaranteed consequence-free speech. It's just guaranteed that the government's not going to arrest you and imprison you for what you're saying in these kind of circumstances. So I think you are seeing, though, people who are conservative activists who are saying we're going to compile lists of employers of people who are making these comments and really strongly pushing for certain people, certain public officials to step down if their comments were viewed as negative. And all of this is just, it's this 24-hour immediate reaction, like Jesse was saying, that sometimes people say things that really, that's a thought that you didn't need to share with anybody else.
And one reason it has to be said that there's been such a backlash, or I don't want to say gloating over his death, but certainly refusing to celebrate his life, or is that he was a fairly confrontational, aggressive by design speaker. He said a lot of controversial things. Many got criticized frequently for saying sexist or racist things. None of that is to justify gloating over his death. I personally think that you shouldn't gloat over anyone's death or celebrate anyone's death, especially for what they say. But compared to just, say, the average Republican, Charlie Kirk was intentionally confrontational in a way that really set off liberals both during his life and during his death now.
All right. Well, I think we will leave it there, but I'm sure there'll be more political talk about this in the many weeks to come. You are listening to the Weekly Reporter Roundtable on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we are talking with Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com, Jesse Balmert from the Columbus Dispatch, and Karen Kassler from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Moving on to redistricting, Democrats took their first stab at what they consider a fair congressional map. It shows 8 seats for Republicans and 7 seats for Democrats. Here is House Minority Leader Dunny Isaacson talking last week when the map was unveiled.
The maps also have competitive districts, which is what voters should have in a democracy. You should get to choose. And there will be some years where, you know, the party that's in power is unpopular and they'll lose some seats. And there'll be some years where the reverse happens.
So, Karen, you know, Democrats are explaining that they want to go from their current 5 seats to 7. They want to take Republicans from 10 seats to 8. Tell me why this will never fly. This will never happen.
Well, Democrats are in the super minority in both the House and the Senate. And so I thought that House Speaker Matt Huffman's reaction to this was interesting, because he was asked by reporters what his thoughts were on this map. And he said that he felt it was gerrymandered and that he felt that it was not in the spirit of what voters had wanted, because it had been developed in secret, and all the things that Democrats have said about Republican maps. Yeah. He said the same thing about their map. So he also said that we shouldn't expect to see a map from majority Republicans until at least next Monday, when a panel of lawmakers is going to meet to go over some redistricting issues. I mean, there's a deadline of September 30th. A 3/5 vote in the House and the Senate must happen to support whatever map. Plus, that it must include half of all the Democrats. It's unlikely that will happen. And then that moves on then to the Ohio Redistricting Commission. They have until the end of October. But also that whatever they approve needs to get Democratic support. And if that doesn't happen, it goes back to the legislature, where a simple majority can pass a map by November 30th. So all of this is, I think we all are expecting that whatever the Republican map is proposed, that's the map that's going to go forward. Mm-hmm. Huffman had said earlier that a status quo map, you know, kind of like the map we have in place now, might look like the map that we get. But that was months ago, and things have changed a little bit since
then.
Well,
let's hear Republican House Speaker Matt Huffman, because he was not entirely happy with the Democrats' effort.
The parties are supposed to sit down and try to come up with a joint proposal by the end of September 30th. Doesn't mean we still can't, but we're off to a bad start when the other side calls a press conference and says it has to be this or nothing else.
Yeah, Jeremy, do you feel like they are off to a bad start, maybe?
I don't think that there was ever much of a chance that they were going to get anything passed by September 30th. I think you know, it's not, nothing was soured because there wasn't that much to sour to begin with. I think it's likely at this point that neither this first phase nor the second phase with the Ohio Redistricting Commission, as Karen said, are going to fly. I think it's likely, I'm not 100%, not preordained, but likely that they're going to go into November when Republicans can pass a map without needing Democratic votes. The interesting thing that Matt Huffman said is if that happens and they go into November and they're able to peel off one or two Democrats, they could pass a new map with an emergency clause, which would mean that the Democrats couldn't seek to hold a statewide election to overturn it. It could take effect immediately. That seems to be a fairly interesting thing that they would only need. They're about one or two votes short of one vote short of the two-thirds majority needed to do that. So that's something I'm going to be watching.
Jesse, talk a little bit about the history here. How will this process go based on what happened a few years ago?
You know, hope springs eternal for every new process, but 2021 and 2022 were pretty dicey. The first round for the congressional map that was passed through the Ohio legislature, it was challenged. It was ruled unconstitutional because it favored Republicans too much. That was a 4-3 decision with a different chief justice at the head. And then this went back. They had to draw a new map that was approved by the Ohio Redistricting Commission, which is this group of 7 people, 4 lawmakers, 3 statewide officials. Majority of that, 5 out of the 7 seats are Republican. That was also ruled unconstitutional. We went to court. Eventually, we used a map, even though it was unconstitutional. So it was messy. And a few dynamics have changed since we did that last. Most notably, the Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, which is tasked with interpreting whether this is a, for lack of a better term, good map or bad map, is much more favorable to the Republicans' version of redistricting. So I don't think you're going to see that court put up as much of a fight as the previous iteration did.
The other thing, too, is we are in, coincidentally, a time when President Trump and his administration have been pushing for redistricting in other states. So,
Ohio has to do this, but other states are doing it just for funsies, right?
just for funsies and to as a way to get Republicans to expand on their narrow majority in the U.S. House. All this redistricting is only for Congress, for the U.S. House of Representatives, not for Senate, obviously, or not for the state legislature. And so that puts more pressure as these other states like Texas, Missouri, Indiana are moving to gerrymander their districts more, and California with Democrats is looking to respond. That puts more pressure on Ohio Republicans to pass a map that expands their majority from 10 to 5 to 12 or 13 to 2, and at the same time puts more pressure on congressional Democrats to resist a compromise that that would just preclude them from saying, OK, we're just going to oppose any attempt to expand Republicans' majority.
And Jeremy, you also wrote about comments that Governor DeWine made back in 2024 about redistricting. What did he vow to do at the time, and has he done it?
Well, at the time, he vowed back in July 2024 that he was pushing voters to oppose Issue 1, which was the redistricting reform amendment, proposed amendment on the ballot. And he said, OK, voters, if you shoot this down because this is a bad proposal, I will push state lawmakers to put another redistricting reform measure on the ballot that would make Ohio's redistricting system similar to Iowa's, where there's a nonpartisan arm of the legislature, the research service there would draw the maps, and then state lawmakers would pass or defeat that. And so he said, OK, I'll do everything I can to make sure lawmakers pass this. And if that doesn't happen, I'll do everything I can to put this on the statewide ballot for voters to create this Iowa style system. Mm-hmm. And that's what he said at the time. Now, when reporters asked him about it last week, he said, well, you know, maybe we can, there's no pressure. Maybe we can get them to look at it, you know, maybe after next decade. And as for the
next decade,
no pressure. And if there was and then when he was asked about this going to the voters for this referendum, he was like, well, I don't think I can raise the money for that. And then when he was asked whether he's tried to raise the money, he just said, oh, well, I just prefer lawmakers handle it. So he's clearly backed off his urgent appeal and his promise to seek this style of reform.
My State House News bureau colleague Joe Ingles had a feature on the air this morning about exactly that. And she talked to one of the groups that was in that coalition, Common Cause Ohio, and Catherine Turser, the executive director, who said that she felt like it may not have been a sincere promise that DeWine had made at the time, that it was really more an effort to get last year's issue one to be rejected by voters, which of course it was. She did not have a whole lot of confidence that anything was going to move forward because nothing has happened since then. And it's true, we've all been kind of asking. He says he wants to see an Iowa-style independent commission, but there really has there haven't been any moves toward that. And even some Republicans last year had said that they knew there was frustration with the redistricting process and that there were people who were even on that side who wanted things to change. But the congressional map this time around will be drawn under the rules that voters approved in 2018, which some find frustrating in light of Supreme Court decisions.
All right. So what we're waiting for right now is in about a week's time, we're expecting to see a Republican map that will look like something. Is that right?
Yes.
And it won't look like the Democrat map that we just saw.
It wouldn't surprise me if the Republicans put out something that basically everyone who's not a Republican is guaranteed to hate. Mm-hmm. And then that doesn't pass. And then as a compromise, quote unquote, that they would put out the map that they intended to do all along. I don't have any inside information that that's what they'll do, but that wouldn't surprise me. So when you see the first map, that doesn't mean it's their final proposal necessarily. It could be, but I wouldn't take it for granted.
All right. We'll see you next week. Coming up, how lawmakers want to fix the affordable housing crisis and also the Ohio National Guard may be staying in D.C. a bit longer. That's when the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides in the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And with me for the roundtable this week, we have Jesse Ballmert, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com, and Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Now, before we jump back into politics, I wanted to talk about football for a moment. Ohio football fans on Saturday had to be Peacock subscribers in order to watch the Buckeyes defeat the Bobcats in 37-9 in a tough win there. The inability to watch the game on regular TV for free infuriated portions of the fan base from both sides. One Ohio senator is among those who has been asking, why should people have to pay for it when it should be free? That's Democratic Senator Bill DeMora of Columbus. He had proposed legislation a while back about this issue. Does anyone know if anything ever came of his bill where he was trying to get these football games on regular TV?
Well, obviously not.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, as I recall, when he proposed it, he was really angry because it was going to be the first game that he hadn't actually been to in like decades. And so
He didn't have tickets.
It was an away game. And he just was furious that you would have to be a Peacock subscriber when there are all sorts of other streaming services that many people are subscribed to. But, I mean, I think this harkens back to arguments we've heard all along from any time that there is publicly funded money involved in stadiums or, you know, where teams play or whatever, that the public who helps pay for those should be able to see those things without paying excessive dollars, I guess. I mean, I can recall Dennis Kucinich talking about it back in the 90s when it was on cable that you'd watch the Cleveland, then the Indians, you know. So
yeah. I mean, and this isn't the only bill about Ohio State football. There's been a couple of bills. One from Josh Williams would ban flag planting flag planting at the 50-yard line, of course.
I remember. Okay.
There's another bill that would forbid noon start times for Ohio State football.
My son's a sophomore and is highly in favor of that one.
So, I mean, no one ever lost an election in Ohio by introducing pro-Ohio State football bills. So.
Jesse, yeah. You were at the game? What was it like?
I was, as a proud alumna of Ohio University. I was impressed by their ability to, you know, hold them a little bit under. And Ohio University scored more points than Texas. So by transitive property, Ohio University is a better football team than
Texas. Obviously.
But yes, Senator DeMora, proud grad of Ohio State, is a fan of these types of bills, though their likelihood of succeeding is pretty slim. And though Peacock is not no one's favorite streaming service to watch football on, there's also Big Ten Network. There's a lot of different hoops people have to jump through to watch Ohio State football.
Yeah. And also, I do know that you were there to see the bands. Go Bands.
Yeah. Yeah. Also an alumna of the Ohio University Marching 110. So I thought it was really cool that they and Ohio State's band did a joint halftime show. It was great and everyone should check it out.
All right. Well, we're not going to solve the Peacock issue, but we can all be mad about it together. So while on the topic of football, though, Jeremy, you are a resident expert on the new Cleveland Browns Stadium, and I haven't gotten an update on that in a while. So why not? What's going on? Anything new? Do we have a new stadium built yet?
No stadium yet. It's still being negotiated out about, because if you remember, Amy, the latest snafu was that officials at the nearby Cleveland Hopkins Airport were saying that the stadium that was being proposed was too high and it would interfere with air traffic. And ODOT, as a result, denied a construction permit. And then there's been negotiations ever since. Initially, it was supposed to be a 30-day deadline, and they kind of blew by that, saying, oh, what deadline? And it remains to be seen now. What's going to happen?
So we're still in a holding pattern there.
And there's still lawsuits over the Modell Law, which was updated in the budget that would say that teams can move within the state and not that was really that's the law that would ban teams from moving or require them to be put up for sale or whatever. So there's still multiple lawsuits on that front. But I think Cleveland is largely moving forward with plans for the current stadium, what's going to happen to that once the team has moved on. So I think that there is kind of an acceptance that they're going to need to redevelop that area or look into some other options for it.
Speaking,
it's a big area. I mean, it's a big chunk of the lakefront.
Speaking of Bill DeMora introducing football bills, didn't he also introduce a bill that said you had to have a certain number of consecutive winning seasons to get any funding for a stadium?
That also has not gone anywhere, but shocking. Then again, neither have the Browns.
So. Ooh. Ow. Yes.
Yeah, I'm a Bears fan, so I'm allowed.
Yes. Truth hurts, though, man. You know,
yesterday was not a good...
My 0-2 Bears. So
call us coming from inside the house.
Yesterday was not a good day for the Cleveland Browns. All right. Moving on, because there's no easy transition to anything else. Jesse, starting today, Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio will no longer be accepting Medicaid as payment. This comes from an appeals court ruling late last week backing a Trump policy. So what does this mean for patients here in Ohio?
Yeah, so Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio serves the Columbus area, but also Toledo, Northeast Ohio, so a large swath of the state, basically everywhere that's not Dayton and Cincinnati. And they will not be accepting Medicaid for services like STIs or contraception. State and federal law already prohibited them from accepting Medicaid for abortion, but they were previously able to accept the public health care for other services. But President Donald Trump and Congress, as part of kind of a lengthy effort to quote unquote defund Planned Parenthood, passed legislation as part of the big, beautiful bill to restrict the ability to use Medicaid for Planned Parenthood for like other services. And so that was part of the legislation. That legislation was on hold for a little bit because of an initial court decision. And then the appeals court said, we're going to keep taking a look at this issue, but you can go forward with mm-hmm. the law and restrict access to Medicaid. Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio says this will impact about 22,000 patients. So this is a large number of people.
Yeah. And Planned Parenthood already did close a couple locations. Is that correct? Or they're reducing staff at least?
Yeah. So there are staff reductions at Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio and then Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio, which is that like kind of Cincinnati-Dayton area, closed some of their locations. And so this was certainly a revenue source for Planned Parenthood. Again, Republicans would say this is not an organization that we want to support with tax dollars. I think you're seeing that on a lot of different issues, you know, across mm-hmm. the board. But certainly this is one that has been a longstanding target for them.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. And we are talking with Jesse Ballmert from the Columbus Dispatch, Karen Kassler from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com. Karen, your colleague Joe Ingles did a story related to affordable housing. The lack of affordable housing in Ohio is a frequent conversation topic here on All Sides. Rents and mortgage payments outpace the median household income, and the problem begs the question, is there something lawmakers can do about it? And it turns out some lawmakers are trying. Republican Senator Reynolds, who led an Ohio Senate committee on affordable housing in 2023, said the new two-year budget offers some solutions. Let's listen.
So any site that is bringing about $700 million in investment to the state or creating 700 jobs, it creates a residential economic development district, a red zone right around that economic development site to build out infrastructure for that local jurisdiction. And what we're doing is we are inviting those municipalities to apply for grant funds. It's $25 million in grant funds. And we've identified about 62 of these sites that would be all over the state of Ohio, not just in our urban areas, but also in our rural and suburban areas.
So Karen, is this happening? Is this something that has bipartisan support and it's a done deal, it's going to happen?
Yeah, Joe kind of dived into all that for our podcast mm-hmm. and talked to lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats on this. And there appears to be bipartisan mm-hmm. support. But that's been the case for property tax law changes, and yet a lot of those haven't gone forward. Mm-hmm. Because I think these two issues are tied together, because once you make one change, it affects things in another area. And so it's difficult to change this one thing and not expect that there would be repercussions. And you have to figure out, okay, how do we manage that? One of the things that appeared to be a conclusion here is that local zoning laws can be a problem. They can be an impediment to building affordable housing. And so what lawmakers can do on local zoning laws is, I guess, a question. There's also a bill that would put some sort of a cap or a tax on high volume landlords to try to stop some of these corporations that are coming in and buying up a lot of affordable housing and making mm-hmm. it unavailable for lower income or even moderate income people to buy houses. So these are discussions that are going on. But these are hard issues, and it once you do one thing, it affects another thing. And so lawmakers really have to come together, I feel like, with a plan that addresses a lot of different issues for anything significant to go forward.
But it also sounds like some of these issues are more local issues. The state's yeah. hands are definitely going to be tied in some areas. So should the state just pass it off and say all the local municipalities need to deal with this?
Well, it's not like the legislature hasn't done things that people would say violate home rule. Yeah. But, you know, that's a question, is how far do you get into local communities? I mean, when you start talking about, say, property taxes and tax incentives that cities will offer for different kinds of development and whether those are always a good idea and how they affect property taxes, they affect affordable housing. There's a lot here that is not going to be solved quickly. And what lawmakers have to do is look down the road. And that can be difficult when you start thinking about passing legislation and how that's going to affect lawmakers, you know, 10 years from now mm-hmm. and city budgets and all that kind of stuff way down the road.
Yeah, there can be some bipartisan support for these ideas because it is kind of like your bread and butter issues. There's not like a Republican or Democratic way to help someone
build a house. Yeah.
Build a house, per se. So there is, it's one of those issues where there is opportunity for solutions and bipartisan solutions. And I think you're seeing that in a lot of the legislation that's been introduced. But as Karen said, these are just really complex issues. You pull at one string and you affect another string. Another area, there's so many different policy problems and possible solutions, is just a lack of property. A pretty reputable source, Sarah Donaldson, was reporting on like the Building Industry Association, says the city of Columbus probably needs double the number of construction it has currently to meet the demand for housing. So there's a lot of different ways state lawmakers could get involved in these issues if they wanted to.
But there's also the implication of whatever happens here could affect economic development, because if you're trying to bring in companies and create jobs, if people have nowhere to live that they can afford reasonably, that can potentially affect employment, hiring, all that stuff.
We are going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about Ohio's National Guard team in Washington, D.C. That is when the Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, we have Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Jesse Ballmert, State Government and Politics Reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Jeremy Pelzer, Chief Politics Reporter at Cleveland.com. And I wanted to jump to the National Guard. So members of Ohio's National Guard have been in D.C. since August. Governor DeWine has been criticized for participating in the federalization of the Guard and has agreed to extend their stay there. Jeremy, what has the governor said about what he's doing with the National Guard?
The governor's stance has been that the Guard's going to be there in support, so they're not going to be there to make arrests, but rather, they will be there either to do backup for D.C. police, or they will be stationed at, say, museums or other landmarks. But then if they see anything that requires an arrest, they will then call in D.C. police, and then those police will make the actual arrest. The governor's latest has been that the Guard is going to be there through the end of November.
That's a long time. I didn't realize it was that long. Okay.
That's what he said last week. And his argument about the criticism he's received was, hey, any president who asks me for National Guard help, I'm going to say yes. Democrat, Republican president, I'm going to say yes. And so I'm not going to second guess the president, who's, especially given that D.C. is a federal jurisdiction and it's not sending it to a state, it's sending it where the federal government has more explicit authority over the running of the city. So that's been his argument. Then he got the question about whether he would approve the National Guard in Ohio cities. And like, he was asked hypothetically if he would send the National Guard to Cleveland, given Cleveland's violent crime rate. And he didn't really directly answer. He just reiterated that the best way to do this is not through National Guard troops, but through police and highway patrol and other more local law enforcement.
Karen, are you surprised that Governor DeWine is leaning into this so much? He's gotten a lot of criticism from different areas for doing this.
Well, he has said all along that this was really something that he felt was along with decisions he's made in the past. I mean, he said it was a request from the Secretary of the Army. He wasn't going to turn that request down, just like he's had requests from mayors of cities during the George Floyd protests and even Minnesota Governor Tim Walz to send troops during those protests. He's gotten requests from southern state governors to send troops after major weather disasters, so that he was going to go along with this request. And I think some of the opposition has died down a little bit. I mean, I think while you've seen videos and pictures of troops picking up trash on the National Mall and things like that, there's also been, I think, some more support for what's been happening. I don't know that there's a lot of support for troops being sent to other cities. And that's the real question, mm-hmm. I think, at this point, that if President Trump wants to push forward with some of the things he said about sending troops to Chicago and other places, that would be a real question to ask, is whether troops from other states should be dispatched to cities in other states.
On a related topic, Cincinnati police will partner with the Ohio State Highway Patrol in an effort to reduce violent crime. What exactly will the Highway Patrol be doing? And is this an unusual arrangement? I'm not sure who's written about this. Was that?
So they signed a memorandum of understanding, and mm-hmm. they're going to do joint enforcement operations. So that's like more traffic patrols by troopers. They're going to investigate things like liquor stores that have been the scenes of repeated crime. There's going to do behind the scenes partnerships between like the city's Gun Intelligence Center and the Narcotics Intelligence Center with the state. And so basically it's city and state officials collaborating to reduce violent crime in Cincinnati.
The mayor, Aftab Purval, says the city has made strides in addressing crime, and he welcomes the help from the state. Let's listen.
In very specific crime segments, we are seeing positive progress. However, it's not enough, which is why we are continuing to deepen our relationship with the governor and his law enforcement resources.
So how is this different? I mean, having the Ohio State Highway Patrol help, is it different than having the National Guard help? I guess, I mean, it obviously is different. There's semantics, different names, different words, different people.
Well, in the governor's mind, yes, because one is the military, the other is civilian law enforcement. Hmm. And so he strikes the difference between having basically the army come in mm-hmm. and having civilian, even it's just state level law enforcement, state police come in. And that's the difference in his mind. Hmm.
Yeah, and I think Mayor Purval, who is a Democrat, is supportive of bringing in the State Highway Patrol. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the resources to have more people on the streets, more assistance, looking into the issues that Jeremy enumerated. So I think that is also the difference. Purval has said he absolutely does not want the National Guard to come to Cincinnati, saying that that would be a waste of resources. And DeWine said that there is no plans to do that. Mm.
All right. Another issue, and it's a question we as a nation have been trying to answer. And here in Ohio, more than 2.4 million people have inadequate access to mental health care. Karen, you wrote about this and how the state's behavioral health workforce has almost doubled since 2013, but that still hasn't been enough. There's been an initiative called Beat the Stigma. So, Karen, what is the goal there, and how are we falling behind when it is for access to mental health care?
Well, in talking to folks who are looking at this, and specifically, this is Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, which is going through a name change in the budget. Mm. They've said, you know, this is a good thing that more people are seeking out mental health care. That's positive, but the number of professionals who are available to provide that is not keeping up. And so they're trying to, some different incentive efforts. There's a stipends and sign-on bonuses for people who have left the provider mm-hmm. Industry, so to speak, and they come back. There's also scholarships for undergrads in their second or final year of college who are looking into going into the field. And so those scholarships could help bring more people in. And also to try to get more training for people who are in the field now who say that they just need more support. They need more training. They need more resources to help them do the job, because it's a very tough job to provide mental health care for people who need it, but then to make sure that you are taking care of yourself as a mental health provider too. So it's tough, and the state is aware of it. So that's, and they're trying to find ways to deal with this.
We've been hearing, I mean, about funding cuts left and right, and state and federal funding cuts to just about everything. Are we keeping funding at least even, or have we increased funding for this?
There were some cuts in some parts of the budget for this agency, but the agency says they really feel like they're able to keep up with everything. I mean, you know, they're doing a lot of work in terms of the judicial system, where you have a lot of mental health issues with people coming in. I mean, the state psychiatric hospitals, most of those people who are in those have come through the justice system, and that's how they're getting there. You've got the 988 suicide and crisis hotline. You've got mobile crisis facilities that are moving around. They say that they're going to be able to set up those in every county. There's a lot going on in the space. And so there were some cuts, but the agency says they're prepared to meet the demand.
What's the name change that you mentioned? Is it just semantics, or why change the name?
They're going to be called the Department of Behavioral Health, because right now, like I said, they are the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And they said that really more clearly represents what their mission is and what they're doing. The idea of taking out the word addiction, I guess, has been, even though that's still what they will be dealing with, making it more of an overview of behavioral health, which covers a variety of different areas.
You're listening to the Weekly Reporter Roundtable from All Sides, and you've been listening to Karen Kassler from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Jesse Ballmert from the Columbus Dispatch, and Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com. Jeremy, the Ohio Supreme Court race for next year is an important one to watch as Republicans look to unseat the only Democrat on the court, Jennifer Bruner. And the cast of characters involved in this race keeps changing. Jeremy, bring us up to speed as to who is running to try to unseat Jennifer Bruner from the Republican side.
Yeah, it's been a roller coaster. This is the race for Jennifer Bruner's seat, who is the only, right now, the only Democrat holding any statewide office in Ohio, at least elected office. And there are right now four people running. They're all judges. Joseph Burke, who's a municipal court judge up in the Cleveland area, a couple of state appeals court judges, Ron Lewis and Andrew King, as well as Colleen O'Donnell, who's a former Franklin County Common Pleas judge. And now there's likely to be a fifth candidate. Her name is Jill Flagg Lansinger, who is a state appeals court judge from Summit County. She told me she's likely going to join the race. She is related by marriage to former Ohio Supreme Court Justice Judith Ann Lansinger. One of the big roller coaster reasons there's been a twist and turn in this race is initially an incumbent Republican already on the court, Pat Fisher, said he was going to run, and he was going to run for a different seat, for Bruner's seat, even though he was in the middle of his own term. But after a state Republican Party screening committee said gave Lewis the recommendation for a state party endorsement, he dropped out. Lewis ended up saying, I'm going to withdraw from the endorsement, and the state party hasn't endorsed anyone. And Fisher now has stayed out of the race. So now we're kind of back to square one with these four candidates. Lansinger is likely to get in, and there might even be more people to get in. And so it's kind of it's up for grabs how this is going
to
go.
Is it unusual to have that many people in our primary for one race?
It is, especially for an Ohio Supreme Court race. And it just shows that the people see the window of opportunity closing as fewer and fewer Democrats are on the court and or anywhere in statewide office. And so they want to go while the getting's good.
It's going to be really interesting how Republican primary voters distinguish between these candidates, many of whom they've just never heard of, because judges are not typically a very prominent position. And so that's why the Ohio Republican Party endorsement seems so critical, but that's up in the air.
And it's a statewide race, so it'll be hard for these judges to campaign all around the state to get their name known. I can imagine there's not a lot of money going into judge races.
And they can't even start collecting money until November under the Ohio Code of Judicial Conduct.
Oh. Well, we have a little more than 2 minutes left, and I just wanted an update. Do we have any updates on any more Democrats filing any paperwork to run for anything. I feel like there's been some seats where Democrats haven't declared a candidate.
Well, last week, John Kulowitz filed to join the race for attorney general. He is a retired partner at a Columbus law firm. He is he managed Gary Hart's presidential campaign in Ohio back in 1984.
He's also a member of the Upper Arlington School Board.
That is City Council.
He's
an Upper Arlington City Council member. And he is joining the primary already. There's former state representative Elliot Forehan from the Cleveland area who's joined. And the winner of that would likely face current Republican state auditor Keith Faber in the November 2026 election.
Right. So, but there are people out there who are still waiting to see, because right now Amy Acton is the declared candidate for governor, but we've been waiting around seeing if Tim Ryan, former congressman, is going to run for anything. He gave us a deadline.
Yeah, Tim Ryan said that he would make a decision before the end of September, which we got a couple more weeks on. So we'll see if there's a primary in that race. There is a primary on the Democratic side for Secretary of State. I think we're waiting to hear a little bit more about auditor and treasurer.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, we have been talking with the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, and I want to say thank you to Jesse Ballmer, State Government and Politics Reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks for being here, Jesse.
As always, go Bobcats.
and go Bands, right? And thank you to Jeremy Pelzer, Chief Politics Reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks, Jeremy.
Always a pleasure.
And Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks, Karen.
Happy Monday.
And this has been the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And thanks to producer Aaron Rabinowitz, as always, for all of her hard work on the Reporter Roundtable. This is 89.7 NPR News.